I am pleased to present an audio recording of the workshop on the Introduction to Yoga Sutras that was held on Saturday, April 15th, 2017. In this session, we discussed the sutras numbers 11 through 15 in Chapter 2 called the Sadhana Pada. I hope you will enjoy the discussion, and as always, I look forward to hearing back from you. Okay, let's close the eyes. Sitting up comfortably tall, relaxed. Let's recite Om three times. Inhale. And open the eyes softly. And as always, we'll start with this invocation to Sage Patanjali. And you can either read from the screen or just close the eyes and listen in. Okay. So if you're trying to sing along with me, inhale. Yogena chittasya padena vacham Malam sharirasya cha vaidyakena yopakarottam pravaram muninam patanjalim pranjaliranatosmi patanjalim pranjaliranatosmi. Gathri, you can read the English translation.
I respectfully bow down with folded hands and offer my salutations to Sage Patanjali, the highest among the munis, sages, who has presented the remedies for removing the impurities of the body through his treatise on Ayurveda, of language through his treatise on grammar, Patanjala, Mahabhashya, and the impurities of the chitta, mind field, through his treatise on yoga, Yoga Sutras of Patanjali.
Very good. So, Patanjali is credited with all these three fields of learning. Okay, so most of you were here last time. You were not here. Okay, and you were not here. This is the first time you were here. I think all of you were here. Gail, you were here last time, right?
Yeah, okay.
All right. So, just as a brief introduction to what we do in these sessions, basically we're trying to focus on some of the basic concepts that are presented in the Yoga Sutras. And we're actually going sutra by sutra. So we are taking one sutra each, you know, every time, and then, you know, going through it very briefly, though not in any great depth, but at least understanding some of the basic concepts related to it. And again, for your basic information, the sutras, there are four chapters actually in this text called the Yoga Sutras. And the first chapter is called Samadhi Pada. Samadhi is the state of the mind where you are absorbed in your total awareness. And it also defines yoga, etc. There's a lot of things in the first chapter. Second chapter is where it talks about the eight limbs of yoga. He starts talking about the eight limbs of yoga. But at the beginning of the chapter, he talks about this concept of klesha. Klesha is suffering. Klesha is the afflictions that we go through. What are these kleshas? What are these sufferings? And then he gets into the cause of this suffering. Okay, so that's what we are working on now. The second chapter, where we are trying to understand what causes suffering, what causes this pain that we carry in our minds, all right? And this is a pretty, in terms of the philosophy itself, it's a pretty heavy chapter. Heavy in the sense it takes you deep into the concept of what's called the Sankhya philosophy. Because most of the basic tenets of Yoga Sutras are actually based on this older philosophy called the Sankhya philosophy. All right, so in these sutras that we are going to cover today, he is really going to get into the guts of this Sankhya philosophy. So just bear with me and also ask questions. Ask me to slow down if you don't understand something. Like I said, this stuff is fairly deep, all right? Because Sankhya philosophy, we are only covering very basic aspects, all right? So last time we covered up to, from my notes, I noticed that we have done up to sutra number 10. Okay, does that seem to match with what you have?
Yes.
10, okay. So now, just for your information, the chapter 1, it's a recap of chapter 1, which I mentioned here. So in that one, we did definition of yoga, which is basically to control the fluctuations of the mind. And then there are five types of these fluctuations or the vrittis, okay? And they are given here. Then the two very basic means of controlling these fluctuations of the mind, one was practice, constant and uninterrupted practice, that's called abhyasa. And the second was non-attachment or detachment. You have to apply both, okay? Both non-attachment as well as detachment. So, first of all, your effort should be to stay non-attached. But if you are attached to something, how do you detach yourself from that? So both the concepts are covered under vairagya. Non-attachment and detachment. And then, of course, there were two kinds of vairagya, lower and the higher vairagya. Now, also in chapter 1, there was this deep concept of Ishvara or God, and we spent a fair amount of time on understanding what that concept of Ishvara was. So that's another concept. Then we also dived into the more depth of what's meditation. Chapter 1 also deals with very details of the concepts of meditation. So we did that also as a part of our discussion on meditation. And on meditation, we spent almost like, what, four or five sessions, I think, just on understanding what meditation is. So much of that was from chapter 1. Okay, so that's roughly what we covered in chapter 1. And then in chapter 2, I'm just going to read through these because we did this last time. So the first thing he defines is in chapter 2, it starts with a concept called the Kriya Yoga or the yoga of, so to say, action. It's the concept where you apply these three activities, tapas, swadhyaya, and Ishvara pranidhana. So these are the three things that he says, they represent what's called the Kriya Yoga. So again, does everyone remember what tapas was? Tapas?
Discipline,
you can call it discipline. Tapas is also toughening up, basically. Discipline requires to toughen up mentally, physically, at every level. You want to make your body, mind, intellect very tough. So you can withstand all the hardships of life, all the dualities of life that afflict us all the time. Okay? So that was tapas. What's swadhyaya? Study of the self through an understanding of what's mentioned in the scriptures. So that becomes swadhyaya, because scriptures tell us what the reality is, what the truth is, and then we apply that to ourselves and then try to study ourselves. Okay? That kind, understanding the scriptures gives us kind of a guideline as to a roadmap as to how to study ourselves, and then we go into that study ourselves. So that was swadhyaya. And what's Ishwar Pranidhana? Surrendering to Ishvara. Ishvara, as I mentioned, we spent a fair amount of time on understanding the concept of Ishvara in the previous sessions, which is God, basically. And to surrender to that entity, which is all perfect in a sense. Right? That's Ishvara. So this combination of these three, tapas, swadhyaya, and Ishwar Pranidhana, he calls it Kriya Yoga. And then he says that this Kriya Yoga, what it does is, there are two things he mentions, right? So one is Samadhi Bhavana, that's the first one. Samadhi Bhavana means, it brings you an awareness of Samadhi. Okay, awareness of Samadhi. Samadhi, everyone knows what Samadhi is, right? So, when you practice Kriya Yoga, it brings you an awareness of Samadhi. The second thing that happens is Klesha Tanu Karanartham. Klesha Tanu Karan. Tanu means diminish something. Tanu means to diminish something, narrow it down, bring it narrow. Reduce something's intensity. Okay, that's called tanu, tanu karana. And klesha, we talked about klesha, you know, also, and that's what chapter 2 starts with, klesha. Kleshas are the afflictions or pain and suffering. So it helps, this practice of Kriya Yoga helps us reduce the effectiveness of kleshas, tanu karana. Okay, so it brings us an awareness of samadhi, and it reduces all the suffering that we go through. Okay, so tapas, swadhyaya, Ishvara Pranidhana will help you calm down, basically. All right? Okay. And then, what are the five kleshas? We talked about that last time. First one was avidya, which is?
Ignorance.
Ignorance of what? Ignorance of ourselves. We'll come to the definition as it's defined here, basically. So we'll look at that. Ignorance, and it's defined here in the next slide. So we'll look at that. And then asmita is?
Ego.
Asmita. Avidya. Asmita. Raga is?
Attachment.
Likes, strong attachments. And dvesha is? Hatred, dislike, you know, total disdain for something, you know, that's the kind of thing that you call dvesha. And then, so raga, dvesha, and abhinivesha. What's abhinivesha?
Status quo.
Maintaining, the desire to maintain status quo, that means the desire to, or a desire to stay, maintain this life, basically. Fear of death, that's what it boils down to. Abhinivesha is the fear of death. Okay? So that's abhinivesha. So these are the five kleshas. And in life, we face these all the time. Death is a reality, but still we don't recognize it. We keep attached to things which we should not be attached to. And that's what causes suffering. We are afraid of things. Always. So that's what is really causing all these problems for us. Right? So that's the five kleshas. And what it says is that in this slide it says avidya is kshetram uttaresham. That means think of avidya, ignorance, as the mother of all these kleshas. That's the root cause of everything else that follows. That's what this slide says. So ignorance is what causes us to suffer in the first place. It's the root cause. And this, these kleshas, they can be in these states, okay, prasupta, etc., etc., and we don't need to go into that. They can be dormant, feeble, intercepted, or sustained. We went through all this in detail last time. But these are the five kleshas. Now, so this is the definition of avidya, okay? Ignorance, okay? So you can read that. Avidya is the... So somebody want to read that English translation? Just so we know. Gail, you want to read that?
Ignorance is regarding the impermanent as permanent, the impure as pure, the painful as pleasant, and the non-self as the self.
Right. So what you said is not knowing yourself, that's what it is. Because we don't know what the true self is, and we keep considering this non-self as the self. This whole body, mind, ego complex, you know, that we consider that as the self, we don't know the reality. And that's what is causing all these problems then. So that was the concept of avidya. And then what is asmita?
Ego.
Kathy, you want to read the definition?
Egoism is the identification, as it were, of the power of the seer, Purusha, with that of the instrument of seeing, the body, mind.
This is where we get into the deep concept of Sankhya. Without understanding some of the Sankhya philosophies, this statement is not easy to understand. What is Drik and what is Darshana? Okay, so that's where we last time also we digressed and then got a glimpse of what the Sankhya philosophy was. Okay, so I'm going to have to repeat that. Okay, so let me just go through these slides because we covered all that. Asmita. Then Raga was?
Attraction.
You know, attachment, etc., etc. Okay, so anytime we have a pleasurable experience, we get attached to it, that's called raga. Anytime we have an unpleasant experience, we hate it, that's called dvesha. Basically, that's what it is. Okay? Okay, and then this one is an interesting... statement, it says, Swarasvahi Vidushopi. Even though you may be a Vidushi, that's Vidush. Vidushaha, okay. That's what it is, Vidushaha, yeah. Even though you may be a Vidushaha, Vidushaha means one who really knows stuff, a very wise person, a very learned person, somebody who has studied everything and understands it all. So he says, even though you may be a Vidusha, but you still have this fear of death. Everybody does, apparently. That's what the statement is. You may be, no matter how learned you are, you still might have a lingering fear of death in your mind. Okay? So that's the abhinivesha, or the fear of death. And then the final thing we talked about last time was that there are four different stages, these obstacles, and this is Swami Sachidananda's translation. He calls them obstacles. They are not obstacles, they are klesha, they are sufferings, they are afflictions. Eventually they become obstacles, but the translation, if you want to do a correct translation, then kleshas are afflictions, not obstacles. I took this from Swami Sachidananda's book, but now I realize that it's not in my understanding. This is not correct. Okay. So, once again, they are heya. Heya means they can be destroyed. Heya. So they are heyas by doing a prati prasava. Prasava means to give birth. Prasava means to give birth. And pratiparsava is the reverse of that. Something that has come out of the womb, can you put it back inside the womb? That's the concept of pratiprasava. Okay? So, he says those kleshas which are at the very subtle level, which are deep rooted in your subconscious, they are not apparently visible to us, they are not causing us suffering now, but they have that potential of exploding one day into tremendous suffering, but they are at the subconscious level. Those can be destroyed only by putting yourself back into the womb. Now, this is where I said I'm going to digress now, go back to Sankhya philosophy, but that's where it all starts. Okay? So, what does Sankhya tell us? Essentially, in Sankhya, there are two entities, and they are called Purusha and Prakriti. Okay? So, where can I write?
You're going to tell us how to bring these back to their primal...
That's what I'm coming to. That's why I need to explain the concept of Sankhya. Okay? Okay, so one is Purusha and the other is Prakriti, all right? They're the two basic entities. What is Purusha and what is Prakriti? That's the key question now. What's Purusha?
It's likened to the soul.
What's that?
Likened to the soul.
You can think of it as the soul, basically. Think of it as the soul, as the Atma, as the pure consciousness, as they say. So Purusha is the pure consciousness. What is Prakriti?
Everything else.
Everything else that we think is the soul, but that's not true. Everything else is the body, is the mind, is the intellect, is your ego, and even, you know, things around us, material things, whatever you can think of. That's all Prakriti, actually. You know, people, at least in our culture, people identify sun as the god, moon as the god, stars as the god, sub people as the god, etc., etc. But all that is still Prakriti. That's a very key concept here in Sankhya. None of that is really Purusha. All right? It's all a part of Prakriti. All right? So there is the only true consciousness is Purusha. Everything else is illuminated by Purusha. And it is through the illumination of Purusha that everything functions. Our intellect also is non-conscious. It does not have consciousness of its own. That's what Sankhya says. It says, everything is non-conscious. The only reason we are able to function is because we are able to borrow the light of consciousness from the Purusha. Okay, but the key concept in Sankhya is that Purusha is separate from Prakriti. They are two independent entities. Independent, but they need each other for maintaining this universe. Both are needed, but they are independent and they are both real. Unlike some other philosophies, they are both real. Okay? When I say other philosophies, you know what I mean. We don't want to get into that. Does everyone know what I mean? Now, the reason I try not to get into those concepts is because then it gets confusing. Because Vedanta, for example, Vedanta is another philosophy which is very, very commonly practiced by a lot of people in India and elsewhere. In that philosophy, this whole universe or this material being entity, which we call Prakriti, they say it's all enveloped with Maya. Does anybody know what Maya is?
Illusion.
Illusion. They say it's illusionary. Well, I'm going to leave it at that. Okay. That can take us a long time to understand all those things. But what I'm saying is, in Sankhya, that's not the case. This whole creation is not an illusion, it's a reality, and it's separate from Purusha, separate from the pure consciousness. They are both beginningless. They have no beginning. There's no identified time equal to zero when we can say that these things started. They're both beginningless. And they're both endless. There's no end to them. Okay? Which is not the case in Vedanta. Okay. So you need to understand that. Now, remember we have been talking about, you know, the evolution of this creation, especially the human creation or the living creation. As far as the human is concerned, we are a composite of how many elements?
23
elements. That's how the evolution takes place, and that's how it is defined in the Sankhya philosophy. That the first thing that comes into existence, well, before I get into that, now, in the beginning, both Prakriti and Purusha exist, like I said, but Prakriti is in its unmanifest state. That's the word they use, unmanifest. That means it has not yet manifested into any of these creation related elements. Okay? In the unmanifest state, there is a concept, it's called the gunas. And there are three gunas. Everyone remember that? Sattva, rajas, and tamas. Now, in the unmanifest state, those three gunas are in a state of perfect balance. Whatever that means. And I say that because there is no real definition of what that balance means. Okay? But they are in a state of balance. It's only when there is a disturbance in the balance of these gunas can this creation take place. And one of those, which is the one called the rajas, or the one related to activity or action, when that begins to dominate, this creation starts. And the first thing, as far as the human is concerned, the first thing that's created is the
intellect,
buddhi. That's the first creation. First thing is created is the buddhi. Then comes before the mind, ahankara,
ego.
So buddhi, ego, and then comes the mind. Okay, manas. So buddhi, ahankara, manas, and then the other 20 elements, they come about. What are the 20 elements?
Five senses.
Five senses, which are sense of hearing, touch, smell, etc. You know that. Five senses. And then? Sense organs. So there are five senses, and each sense has an associated organ with that. Sense of smell has nose, sense of hearing has ears, etc., etc. So five senses, five sense organs. Then the next is? Five senses of organs of action. Five organs of action, which are?
Hands.
Hands and arms, yep. Feet and legs, yep. That's number two. Number three is?
Reproductive
organs. Number four?
Elimination.
Number five?
think about it.
What about like heart?
Speech, tongue. So there are five organs of action. Hands and arms for movement of the lifting things like that, throwing things. Feet and legs for locomotion. Speech, tongue for the speech, which is the most dangerous, as we know. And then, of course, elimination and reproduction. So those are the five organs of action. And then finally, five
elements.
They're called Mahabhutas, elements, which are the elements of air, water, ether, fire, and what did I smell? Smell, okay? No, what did I miss? Earth, water, fire, air, and ether. Did I miss any?
Yes.
Five. That's five, yeah, that's five. Okay. So that makes up this human being. These 23 elements. And the grossest of these is the element of earth. Okay, that's the at the lowest level, so to say. Earth. So they go like this: earth, water, fire, air, ether, and then you go into the five senses. They are more subtler. The mind is subtler than the five senses. Ego is subtler than the mind, and finally, the subtlest is the intellect. What they are saying, pratiprasava is the ability to take these things back to the womb. So what they are saying is that these kleshas, which are rooted in our subconscious, right, these five kleshas, they are rooted in our subconscious. And the cause for these is this entire complex of mind, ego, and the intellect. That's the root cause of all these kleshas, ego, and of course memory. The memory is where it's all stored, but then the ego works on it, the mind works on it, and the intellect works on it. The grossest of these three is the mind, then comes the ego, then the intellect. Intellect as the most subtle level of all these three. What it's saying is, you go start going backwards. Let the mind merge into ego, let the ego merge into intellect, and eventually let the intellect merge back into the unmanifest prakriti, which can happen only if we are able to rebalance these three gunas. Sattva, Rajas, and Tamas. So the whole concept of this pratiprasava, or taking things back to the womb, means that we are now fully, of course, we first have to fully understand what these three are, Rajas, Sattva, and Tamas, and then understand what their balance is. Okay? Completely, when they are balanced, then we are able to bring ourselves back to the state of original unmanifest state. And that's called the pratiprasava. And at that point, nothing will matter to us then. We are always going to be fat, dumb, and happy, as they say.
Those are linked to the doshas, correct?
Well, according to Ayurveda, they are linked to the doshas, yes. Patanjali doesn't talk about that concept, but once you study Ayurveda, they will say that these kleshas can be linked back to the doshas. Doshas are these. Three doshas according to Ayurveda, Vata, Pitta, Kapha. I don't know, some of you might know these terms. Okay. She just did a course on Ayurveda, so she's very familiar with that.
I know,
that's how it is. All right. So that's the main concept of pratiprasava, how to align yourself back to the original source, which is it's called the Mula Prakriti, that the unmanifest state, it's called the root of the Prakriti, called Mula in Sanskrit, M-U-L-A. Okay, so now we can move forward. Okay. So the remember the previous sutra said the ones which are at a very subtle level, which are deep into our subconscious, they have to be merged back to the original source. Then only they can be removed. But the ones which are not...
So you have to get into perfect balance before...
Yes, yes, yes. Because once the kleshas are removed, we are perfectly happy. Happy in the sense that we have no more worries, no more kleshas then. And that can only be done when we have attained the final state of samadhi. Absolutely the final state of samadhi. And that's called, in the Yoga Sutra, it's called the nirbija samadhi. Nirbija. Bija is seed. Nir means without seed. That means we have been able to eliminate the last seed in our mind. When there's no seed, there's no klesha. Nothing to worry about. So that state is called the nirbija samadhi. All right.
Can you quickly remind me the sattva, rajas, tamas, like what they are?
Sattva is very briefly, sattva is purity basically. Something that's pure, clean, elements like, or the qualities like kindness, truthfulness, purity of the mind, purity of the body, all these come under the element sattva. Okay? Rajas is more action, more activity, more, you can say, ambition, desire to have, more things, right? That's rajas, gung-ho, type A activity. I must get there, otherwise I'm nothing. That kind of attitude and that kind of behavior, they will fall under the category of rajas. Okay? When you're on the go. And tamas is just the opposite. When you have no energy and you just want to while away your time, sit and watch TV with a bag full of potato chips in your hands and do nothing. Couch potato. And you're dull, and even in terms of the mental activities, all you think of is negative stuff. How can I kill this person? How can I get my revenge from this person? I'm no good. I'm so guilty of doing this, and you should be ashamed of yourself. All those negative stuff. And the negative things like anger, jealousy, kama, krodha, lobha, moha, and all those six qualities, they all fall under the category of tamas. In this book, Bhagavad Gita, anybody studied Bhagavad Gita? You've studied some.
A while ago, I read it.
Okay. Okay. Bhagavad Gita has a very nice description of these three gunas. Okay. And what I have started doing is pull together all the shlokas in the Bhagavad Gita that relate to these concepts of sattva, rajas and tamas. Okay? So if anybody is interested, I can share that with you. It's a long list of shlokas. It won't make sense unless you try to understand them. Okay, but I find fascinating that Gita has a very good discussion on these concepts of sattva. And I'm fascinated by this concept myself. So I said, let me pull those out, so I can then look at them and see what they all mean. Yeah. And there are a large number of them. Out of 700, my feeling is at least 100, about 100 are devoted to that concept. Okay. And then, of course, your mind can be in a state of sattva, rajas or tamas. Your food can be sattva, rajas or tamas. Your actions... And Gita talks about even, when you give charity, for example, that could be based on sattva, rajas, or tamas. All your qualities of life can be one of these three, etc., etc. So there's a lot of discussion on that. What is sattva, rajas, and tamas? Because everything in Prakriti is that. It's based on that. Okay. Does that kind of roughly...
Oh, yeah,
okay, so the previous one said the sukshma are the subtle ones. Those are there at the deep level of subconscious. they can only be removed by eventually getting to the final state of samadhi. But the ones which are more obvious, which are the vrittis, which is already on the surface of the mind, which are visible to us, which are active at this point. All these kleshas which are active at this point, they become vrittis, right? If I have an attachment, it's going to bring about something, desire in my mind, maybe. If I hate something, it's going to bring up maybe anger or whatever. All these are vrittis in the mind, but they are right now on the surface, they are visible, they are active. So those vrittis which are now available, you know, for observation, and they are doing their job now, they can be destroyed by meditation. Okay? So for the subtle ones, you have to get into the final state of samadhi. But the more grosser ones, they can be taken care of through meditation. Okay? And once you are, then as you know, meditation will eventually lead into samadhi anyway. That's the first step. So first you have to suppress these more obvious ones and keep working on the mind. And then at a subtler level, you will be able to go into deep states of samadhi when everything else will be destroyed. So that's how it is all mentioned here. So before we do that, we always repeat the sutra itself, okay? So, it's just one of the things we've been doing. So, just repeat after me. Dhyana. Heyaha. Tadvrittayaha. One more time. Dhyana. Heyaha. Tadvrittayaha. So, the whole thing, when you combine it together, it becomes Dhyana Heyas Tadvrittaya. So that letter S comes in the middle after you combine, when you combine these individual words. That's the rule of grammar in Sanskrit. Okay? So dhyana heyas tadvrittayaha. Let's do that one more time. Very good. So that's the next one. And this is the next sutra is again an important one. Let's read through the sutra first. Klesha mulaha karmashayaha drishta adrishta janma vedaniyaha. So let me read that one more time. Klesha mulaha karmashayaha drishta adrishta janma vedaniyaha. Okay, now again, when you combine these words, things change slightly. But let's not read the whole thing, that will be quite confusing for everyone. So let's leave it at that. Now, what does that mean here? Klesha mula. Mula is root. Most of you know that mula bandha and all that, right? Mula dhara chakra, mula bandha. These are the common yogic terms. Mula means the root. So, klesha mulaha karmashayaha. Karmashayaha is the store or the bag of your karmas. Ashaya is the storehouse, bag or the container. That's the ashaya. Karma is the all your karmas. What's karmas? What's karmas?
Almost like duties.
Actions and the results of actions. And actions can be good or bad, right? Punya or apunya, pap or apunya. That's how they define that in yoga and other our cultures, right? So you can have sinful actions or non-sinful actions. That's how they define it in English. Okay, there are only two types, right? Well, of course, there's another one mentioned here. Black, white, and mix of black and white, things like that. Okay? So, when we do any action, action here also means thought. Thought is also an action. It's considered an action. When we have a thought, it could be good or bad thought. But it's going to create an impression in the mind. It's called, every impression is called a sanskara or samskara, right? Okay? So it depends. The pronunciation varies. If you are from the south of India, they call it samskara. From where I am, we call it sanskara. Or maybe you also call it sanskara. Okay. That's just a minor difference.
In South India, Sanskrit is Sanskritam.
Right, right. So, minor differences.
Yeah.
Okay, so, the impressions that we have in the mind, they are called samskaras. And then we also attach these raga and dvesha to every samskara. Likes and dislikes, desire to have a repeat performance of the same action that we liked, or to have no repeat whatsoever of something that we disliked. All that becomes a part of the samskaras. Okay? Now, remember, these samskaras are which eventually come up and drive more action. Okay? If you have a desire, you're going to have more action. If you have a hatred for something, more action. If you have hatred, you might hit somebody, kill somebody, you know. All that is driven by the samskaras, basically. And they will create more action, more impressions. Every action creates more impressions. And everything gets stored in that bag full of samskaras or the impressions called the karmashaya. That's the word karmashaya. Now, what causes these actions? Kleshas. The actions are caused by kleshas, right? Kleshas are what? Avidya, asmita, raga, dvesha, or ignorance, ego, etc., etc. It's because of that we are doing actions or thinking of things because of the five kleshas. So what he's saying is that as long as we have kleshas, we're going to have actions, and therefore karma ashaya is going to keep building up. Right? And these karmas, they bring about experiences, new, fresh experiences. And when do the experiences come? In drishta. Drishta means something that can be seen, which is this life. Or it could be adrishta. When you add the prefix a, it becomes non-seeable, which is future life. So you can have experiences based on your karmas, either in this life or a future life. So this concept of reincarnation is deep-rooted into the concept of yoga. It's a part of the yogic philosophy. People ask me, why should I believe in reincarnation? I don't understand this. My simple answer is, neither do I, but it's a part of the yoga philosophy. Okay, that's how many of these concepts are explained. It's all based on this concept of reincarnation or rebirth. And it's the whole purpose of yoga is to get you out of this cycle of birth and death, birth and death. That's how it is. Right?
So is the intent that the meditation reduces the influence of the five?
Yes.
Kleshas?
Yes.
And therefore, you're not making more deposits in your karma bag?
Fewer deposit, yes, yes, yes. So you're able to do two things. One is you're able to reduce the amount of, your impressions that you're creating. Secondly, you're already burning some of the old karmas that you're going through life in anyway, so they are getting burnt out anyway. So eventually the bag might either get empty. But again, there is the concept here is, since you mentioned this, if we attain self-realization in this life, the bag may still have a lot of karmas in there, because we haven't finished our life yet. We're still living, and therefore there is something in the bag. But if you attain self-realization today, and you are able to maintain that, obviously, you know, then no matter how much stuff is still left in the bag, when your body disappears, you will not carry anything forward. That means you will not be reborn. That means all your past impressions will be wiped out. You see, let me take a minor digression. There are three types of karmas, right? I talked about that. Does anybody remember those three words?
Yeah.
Sanchita karma,
prarabdha,
agami karma. Okay. What does sanchita karma means?
Accumulated
karma. It's the total bank balance, so to say, the complete total bank balance that you have from times immemorial, lives immemorial, right? Millions of lives before, you have been accumulating karma, and the total of all that is called sanchita karma. At the time of birth, though, you're only given a very small subset of those karmas that you have to live through in this life. And that is called the prarabdha karma. So there's a big whole bank balance, okay, let's say $1 million, and then you're taken out of that maybe a few $100,000, and then you're supposed to live your life with that. But the remaining part is still back in your karmas, in the bag. That's in the bag, it's still there. And then when you live through this life, you're creating more karmas or you're eliminating some of this, etc., etc. All this is happening. But the point is, if you attain self-realization in this life, then even the ones that were, you know, left in the main big bag, they'll become ineffective also.
What's the third karma?
Third is the agami karma. Agami is the one you are now creating now, okay, for future. So if you do good deeds now, you'll create some positive karma. If you do bad deeds, negative karma, etc. Okay. So, the kleshas become the root cause of all the karmas because they are the ones which drive all our actions, all our thoughts, all our behavior patterns, and that's what is going to fill up our karma bag called karmashaya. And this karma bag will eventually end up giving us new experiences either in this life or a future life. That is this sutra. Klesha mulaha karmashayaha drishta adrishta janma vedaniyaha. Vedaniya means experiences, has to be experienced. Okay, so it can be either in drishta janma, which is this life, or adrishta janma, which is a future. Janma is life or a birth. Okay, so in this birth or adrishta janma means a future life, and vedaniya means experienced. Okay, so these are the Sanskrit terms.
So I have a question. So you say meditation diminishes all the kleshas, but the karma, maybe good karma and bad karma too. So will it diminish good karma also?
The point is, karmas will remain there, good or bad, it doesn't matter. Okay? If you have good deeds, it may destroy some of the bad karmas, call them nullify or so. But that bag, the karmas remain there. The purpose of meditation is eventually to attain self-realization, which is to go beyond this concept of avidya. That means now you have attained the understanding of who you truly are, and you have merged with the true essence of Purusha. When you do that, then it doesn't matter what's in the karmashaya. That's the whole point. Whether good or bad, they'll all be there, but they'll be ineffective.
So even if they need to fulfill their action because of the certain karma, it won't affect you because you're already
there.
You can watch it happen and you're not going to be affected by it.
Yeah, you can enjoy it then. It's like a movie, then, you know. Yeah. You just enjoy the movie, it's happening, because it's prarabdha, because it's already there in your bag. You've got to live your life, which means that if the prarabdha says that that at the age of 60 you're going to get cancer, you will get cancer. It's okay. Just enjoy that. And there are examples of people who understood that, and they said, yeah, I understand this, it's my karma. But they were realized enough that it didn't bother them. Ramana Maharshi was there, Ramakrishna Paramahansa. He had cancer in the throat. He says, don't worry about it. He says, "It's I know it." Didn't care. Didn't bother him at all. And he was, despite his cancer, he was giving his talks, laughing, dancing, jumping around whenever he could, as much as he could. He says, cancer is there, it's okay.
Who was that, sir?
His name is Ramakrishna Paramahansa, Ramakrishna. And he was a realized soul. So, and this is very, not too long ago, this is fairly recent, just one generation ago. Same with Ramana Maharishi, the same thing. And nothing bothered him. Fully realized. Okay? Because they know that, you know, this prarabdha karma has to be lived through, but doesn't bother them. Okay. So the next one is, let's read the shloka, sutra. Sati mule tadvipakaha jati ayuhu bhogaha. So again, I'm going to go slow. Sati mule tadvipakaha jati ayuhu bhogaha. Now it looks different when you combine all the words, okay? So jati, ayuhu and bhogas, when you combine, it becomes jatyayur bhogaha. Okay, that's the Sanskrit way of combining different words which are next to each other. Okay? So mule, again, root, because they are at the root of everything. Okay? Sati mule means because of their being at the root, they will fructify, they will become, they will bring about vipaka. Vipaka means to bring fruit. So if you put a seed in the ground, it becomes a tree, and when it brings fruit, it's called vipaka. Paka or vipaka. Okay? In Hindi, we say pak jate hain. Okay, that's the term in Hindi. It's all derived from the same root. Root word pach. That means they become fruits. Now, when they become fruits, what do they bring? They can bring about a jati. Jati means the kind of birth. Whether you are, first, the gross differentiation is you could be born as an animal or a human being or a bird or something else, who knows, insect.
How do you make any changes as a dog? I mean, that seems to me like...
Okay, so, again, we don't know what a dog knows or whether what he thinks or not. But as humans, what we believe, when I say we, I'm talking about these realized yogis, what they believe, that it's only in the human birth that you can eventually attain realization. Okay? When you have life, any other life other than human being, you just live through it because you have been given that prarabdha. At that time, you're not causing any karma, you're not diminishing any karma.
Then why have it? It just seems like a waste.
Well, I mean, it's a waste, but you created that waste. The point is, that's exactly what they say. We are the creators of the waste. We have not done good stuff in this life, so we are condemned to become a snake or an insect in the next life, but we have to go through that span of life. That's it. It's a waste, but it's created by us. That's what it's saying. Jati, Ayuhu. Ayuhu means the lifespan. If you're a dog, you have a certain lifespan. If you're a whale, there is a certain bigger lifespan. If you're an insect, it may be a few minutes, who knows. But you have to go through that. So jati, ayuhu, and bhogaha means what experience you get. Good experience, bad experience, pleasant, unpleasant, everything is, comes under bhoga. Bhoga means life's experiences. So, because these are rooted in the, in these kleshas are rooted in the karmashaya, and because we have these karmas, therefore we are going to have the fruits of this in future lives, and these fruits will be in the form of jati, means what kind of life it is. And jati also, they say, means that whether you'll be born in the family of a rich man, poor man, good man, you know.
I was going to say that jati literally, actually, if you're born a human, like kind of like the Indian caste system, that correlates.
Well, whatever, you know, yeah, it could be anything. You could be born in the nobleman's family or a killer's family, whoever, you know. Okay, so that's the concept of jati here. Jati also means the what kind of incarnation you have. Okay. And then ayu, usually just the lifespan, that's the word ayuhu. And bhogaha is or the, what do you experience in life during that incarnation. So that's this sutra. Okay. Now this is a very simple statement. I think we all know that. So let's read this. Te halad paritap phalaha punya apunya hetutvat. Okay, let me read that again. Te halad paritap phalaha punya apunya hetutvat. Okay, hetu is cause. So because of punya or apunya, punya means good deeds, apunya means bad deeds. Okay, so because, hetu means cause. Okay, because of punya or apunya, these karmas from the previous bag will bring about halada, which is happiness, or paritapa, which is pain, suffering. Very simple. Okay? So, halada means very pleasant experiences. Halada means a sense of happiness. Okay, that's halada. Tapa means suffering. And paritapa means intense suffering. Tapa is the same thing from tapas. Okay, the tapas we said is the austerities or going through, you know, toughening up. From that the word derived is tapa, which usually means suffering. Okay, so because of our punya means the good deeds, apunya means bad deeds, and because of those we are going to experience either pleasure or pain. That's fairly simple. This is very common in our Hindu culture. You know, as you grow up, that's the first thing you hear. Hey, if you do good things, you will have a good life. If you do bad things, you will have a bad life. So don't do any bad things. And then next thing you know is everyone is doing bad stuff.
Apunya is same as papa.
Yeah, yeah. Say that again.
Apunya is the same as papa.
Yes, yes. Okay. Yeah, yeah. You know, when I was growing up, I'm reminded of this. My house was right next to the police station, actually. And in those days, the custom was actually, this was, I'm talking of, you know, more than 60 years ago. the customers, when they brought these prisoners into the police station, and to get them to tell the truth, they used to actually physically beat them up, torture them. All right? So in our house, every day we would hear this sound. Oh, you're killing me. Oh, you Mardia, 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 you know. Because they will jump up in pain when they would be hit with the cane or something, you know. So I grew up being, you know, almost traumatized by these sounds. So I couldn't understand why we have to live right here.
Yeah.
Right next to the police station. And these sounds were loud. You know, they would really cry out in pain.
And, you're happy when you moved.
I tell you. Fortunately, my father had a very transferable job, so every 2 years we would move. So, well, that's what I was thinking. You know, my mother would say, do good things, you'll have a good life, and then suddenly you hear a cry from the back, you know.
Oh, gosh. Oh, my gosh.
Traumatic. Okay, all right. This is a very, very pregnant sutra. Okay, let's read it. Parinama, tapa, sanskara, dukkhaihi, guna, vritti, virodhaccha, dukkhameva, sarvam, vivekinaha. Okay, let's do it one more time. Parinama, tapa, samskara, dukkhaihi, guna, vritti, virodhat, cha, dukkham eva, sarvam, vivekinaha. Okay. Viveki is one who has attained, who is close to attaining self-realization. Viveki is one who has now understood the difference between right and wrong. He has attained viveka. Viveka is discrimination. So he has the ability to discriminate between right and wrong, good and bad, real and unreal and all that. That means he is close to being free of avidya, ignorance. Avidya was the same thing, right? Not knowing the difference between real and unreal, etc. Viveki is the one who knows the difference between real and unreal, self and non-self. So he is very close to self-realization, almost like the last stage before self-realization. All right? That's a viveki. So for that viveki, this whole statement applies to that. He says, even for that viveki, because of all these things, parinama, tapa, samskara, dukkhaihi, and we'll come to these terms one by one. Okay. Sarvam dukkham eva. Sarvam means everything in this life is dukkham, is pain. Doesn't matter what it is. Everything is painful. For a person who is close to realization, he recognizes that everything in this life is painful, no matter what it is. And why is that? The reasons are given as parinama. Parinama means transformation or change that's going on in life. Tapa is, remember we heard the term tapa, which is pain and suffering. Samskara, we know what samskara is. And because of the dukkha that all this creates, anxiety, etc. And also, this is one thing, then there is a confrontation between the different gunas. Guna vritti. Gunas cause vrittis, and there is conflict between them. Virodha means conflict. There's a constant conflict going on between the gunas. And because of all that, no matter how, you know, what your state is, everything eventually will be suffering. That's the meaning of this sutra. Okay? Commentators, you know, they have spent pages and pages explaining why Patanjali thinks everything is suffering and all that, you know. So it's an important sutra to understand. All right. So let me see if I have anything. Okay. All right, let's go through these words one by one. See, unfortunately, I don't seem to find time to expand on these slides to give more bullets and all that. We just have to do it through words. So what's parinama?
Parinama. Hmm? Really, it's like result or like...
Transformation, basically. Parinama means change, transformation. Okay, and also it applies to the results, as you say. Okay, but more importantly, in our case, it's transformation that's going on constantly. We are in a constant state of flux all the time. Our body is in a constant state of flux. Our mind is in a constant state of flux. Everything that we have in the mind is constantly changing. Change brings about fear. Fear brings about suffering. Change is fearful, always. Any change, it brings about fear and then associated suffering. So parinama, it's easy to understand. Any transformation that we go through, you know, start looking at things that we go through in life, like birth of a child, painful initially, very painful, right? Then the fear is how I'm going to bring it up, you know, oh my God, buy that, go this, do this, I need money, I need all this, you know, millions of clothes, pain, suffering, right? It's mixed with everything, right? But there is that element of pain. When is this kid going to grow up? You know, he's never growing up. When he grows up, you should have remained a child. You are such a pain in the, you know, so pain, change, transformation means pain. When you grow up, when are you going to graduate from school and leave me, you know, alone in this house? You know? When the son leaves the house, oh my God, you should have stayed at home. I have nobody to talk to now. You know? I'm painful. You don't get a job, oh my God, when am I going to get a job? You get a job, oh my God, how am I going to do it? You know, I don't know. Suffering. When you're not married, oh my God, when am I going to get married? You are married, when am I going to get rid of this person now? Yeah. Miserable. The point is, parinama basically implies some kind of suffering. Because it's associated with fear. Every change is associated with fear, which means suffering. Tapa is just, you know, tapa could be anything. It could be some grief that we are going through that, you know, is more intense. This is more intense form of suffering, tapa. You know, some death in family, you know, that causes a lot of intense pain, grief. That's tapa. Okay, or you have some huge animosity with somebody and, you know, you can't sleep at night. That's tapa. You know, more intense form of, you know, intense feelings, you can say. That's tapa. Samskara, we know that. Samskaras bring about all kinds of actions, all kinds of movements, everything, and they are painful, suffering. So with all this, there is suffering associated, right? Now, gunas, again, are a cause of suffering, right? Gunas, what are gunas? Sattva, rajas, and tamas. And they are constantly changing. They are constantly in a state of flux, these gunas. That's just the nature of the gunas, all right? At a given moment, you could be very sattvic. You want peace and quiet. You're listening to some beautiful music and all that. And while doing that, suddenly you realize, oh my God, I had put milk on the burner and then it's going to blow up, burn out and run away, and everything turns into rajas and your mind goes into totally a different state. Or suddenly, I'm so tired, I want to rest. So there is a constant change going on in the form of these gunas. And every guna, like we said, creates vrittis in the mind, creates fluctuations in the mind of its own kind, right? Now, every fluctuation causes more action. Vrittis will cause action. It's all a big cycle, right? Gunas will cause vrittis, vrittis will cause action. Action will cause more karma, and then we will be, depending on the guna that is dominant, you will be doing good deeds or bad deeds. It's a big cycle going on. Everything eventually turns into pain and suffering. Okay, there's always constant churning going on in the mind, and that's what it is referring to. So what it says is that for a person who has attained discrimination, he knows that even something that is pleasurable now will eventually turn into pain. Every pleasure is short-lived, in a sense. Okay? So this, some people think this is too pessimistic, but needs a little more reflection to really understand the essence of this sutra. Right? Okay. So, let's read the sutra. Heyam dukkham anagatam. Heyam dukkham anagatam. So the full sentence is very simple. Heyam dukkham anagatam. All right. What's heyam? What does it mean, heyam? Avoidable. Or reducible, avoidable, etc. Heyam. Anagatam means Agatam means which has come already. Anagatam means which has not come yet. So something that is going to happen in the future. So what this sutra is saying, that a dukkham or the pain that has not yet come is avoidable. That means you don't have to go through any future pain now. What you're going through now, or what you have accumulated from the past, you may not have enough control over that. You may have to go through that. Okay? Some of it you can still control it. But some, you may just have to go through it. But something that has not come is certainly avoidable. Heyam dukkham anagatam. You don't have to plan for suffering. That's the whole thing here. Right? So if there's suffering that has not yet come, we can avoid it. Okay?
Isn't that sort of the opposite of the last one? That everything is suffering?
Everything is suffering, right? But that's because of the current state of the mind, because of the gunas, because of all the changes in the gunas, because of the transformations that are going on. Yeah. But wait. But this is something that has not yet come. That's everything that's going on now is suffering. According to the previous sutra, everything that we are going through now is eventually suffering. But the real, in the real sense, it is avoidable. This is what is coming to now. Why is it avoidable? How it is avoidable? What is suffering? What is causing all this? That's what's coming up now. All right.
Somebody who has attained that state.
Yes.
For normal people like us who have not quite attained that
state. Yeah, then we are suffering through this anyway.
But okay. We don't see everything as
suffering. Yes. Because if you like a piece of cake, it's pleasant. It's pleasurable for us. We enjoy it. We don't realize that tomorrow it might cause us pain. That's what the whole point is. right? We like a piece of cake, even though we are diabetic, we are still going to enjoy it, you know. That's okay. One piece of cake, who cares? You know? And so that's basically what it means. We don't realize that eventually everything will boil down to, can boil down to, but it's avoidable, future pain.
So this, I believe, is applicable to everyone. So we can actually think of, like, think that we do not have to, like, you know how there's always, like, this sense of dread of what is about to come. Like, we feel like, oh, like, you know, kind of like the doomsday, like something bad is going to happen. I feel like this is applicable to everyone, that if we don't have to always feel like something bad is about to happen or pain is about to come, we can always think that it's avoidable.
That's what it's saying.
Yeah.
Actually, I don't understand the statement at all. So, pain that has not yet come means, like, you know, whatever the bag of karmas you have, you have to go through that. That is not avoidable. Isn't it? Unavoidable. So, is it with respect to, like, viveki or aviveki?
Well, you know, I think the point is here that once you attain self-realization, right, then there's no pain.
Though we are feeling it as a pain now, once we get the self-realization, you will not feel that.
So what we're trying to do is to understand the distinction between pain and suffering. Okay? If I get a cut here, you know, I'm going to have pain. Okay? I'm going to have pain. Is it going to cause me suffering? What's the distinction between pain and suffering? Pain is unavoidable. I'm talking of, you know, physical pain at this point, let's say. Right? You get into an accident, you break a leg. There's going to be pain. Right? I had a shoulder surgery, it's immense pain. So, you know. But are we allowing it to cause us suffering in the mind? Am I going to say, oh my God, my shoulder is gone, how am I going to teach yoga, and, you know, my God, my life is gone, you know, I can't take care of myself, and how can I take care of anybody else? And you might say, I might lose my job because of this, and that's suffering. Okay, that's created by the mind because of all those parinama, tapa, etc., etc., all the ego-based stuff. All right. So if we can distinguish between pain and suffering, you know, we're taking a step in the right direction.
To me, it's almost like karma. You don't have to make any more karma. Is that the word to put in there instead of pain or something?
Well, karma causes pain, right? Karma causes pain.
So karma that you haven't done yet, or actions that you haven't performed yet, may be avoidable if you're aware enough to be, you know, self-realize that you don't have to do those things anymore, cause any more pain to yourself. But that only comes with, you know, self-knowledge.
Right. So, again, the example of, you know, Paramahansa, Ramakrishna Paramahansa, right? Now, he at a given time, he would have thought, my cancer, oh my God, how I'm going to teach my students, and, you know, how I'm going to conduct my religious activities and all that. But after he was self-realized, that future pain didn't bother him. Then there was no pain at all. Even though he had cancer, he was physically suffering immensely, but did not cause him any mental pain, mental suffering. Because he was able to avoid that through these practices. He was able to attain self-realization. So at that given time when he attained self-realization, there was no future pain for him, even though he was bound to get cancer in the future.
Did he attain self-realization?
Can it also mean that the karmas which are not prarabdha karmas, which is supposed to be bringing pain in the future lives, can be avoided by having a samadhi?
Well, once you attain...
In this life.
Once you attain... I don't think we are talking of that.
In this life, all the karmas that is to be suffered in the future...
They disappear, yeah. So the karma bag will disappear after this life is done. It's gone now.
Actually, that was my question. Yeah.
Okay, so like we said, you know, once we attain self-realization, then there is no question of future life.
Right.
So whatever is in that bag...
Avoid those karmas, you should attain self-realization in this life.
That's right. As soon as possible, basically.
Okay.
Because Patanjali also says that it will take more than one lifetime. So,
Who knows how many times we've done
it. Okay, so so it's not going to happen in this lifetime for most of us. But having made a start, it's a good start, you know.
Did he obtain self-realization through his pain?
Who?
The guy you were talking about, with cancer, did he obtain self-realization through the pain he was suffering?
No.
Did he use that pain to become self-realized?
No. He didn't have any pain at that time. I mean, what I'm saying, cancer happened much later in his life.
Oh.
Okay, what I'm saying is, he was able to avoid the pain of cancer by self-realization, because when the cancer happened, he didn't suffer any pain at all. It just happened. It was just happening in life.
And can you say he just accepted that as a fact?
Absolutely. He just accepted it as it is.
And then resisted.
And he kept going, you know, as long as he could. He still was giving his, you know, talks. He was still going, having his discussions. And despite the fact that he had cancer at one point, physically he was painful, he just got up and started dancing. Because in that state of total samadhi, he didn't know what he was doing. They say he just started dancing.
Pain is inevitable, suffering is optional.
That's a good way to put it, yes. Mm-hmm. Ramana Maharishi is a similar instance, you know. He died very young, but he had no suffering, basically. He did not suffer. Vivekananda, he died very young. But no suffering. He was in his, 38 or 39 when he died? And look at what he achieved in that time frame. Amazing stuff. By the age of 38, he had so much achievement. But no suffering when he died. Nothing. That's what the essence of this is, that you can avoid future suffering. Okay, so now he gets into this, again, the concept of Purusha and Prakriti, a little more details of that, which is again Sankhya. This is the gut of Sankhya philosophy, you know, we're getting into. And commentators have spent a lot of time explaining all this, you know. Pages and pages and pages. So we're going to cover that in a very brief time frame. Okay. Actually, what I'm going to do is to just read this sutra. It's almost 3:35 and I'm getting kind of tired now. We might just read the sutra and I'll explain it next time, maybe. Let's see how it goes. Let's read the sutra. Prakasha, Kriya, Sthiti Shilam, Bhutendriyatmakam. So let me break that. Bhuta, Indriyatmakam. So it becomes Bhutendriyatmakam. Bhoga, Apavargartham. So it then becomes Bhoga Apavargartham. Trisham. Okay. So let me read that one more time. Prakash. Kriya. Sthiti Shilam. Bhutendriyatmakam. Bhogapavargartham. Drisham. Drishya means something that is seen. Drishya means something that is seen. And in this context, drishya simply means prakriti. Prakriti is that is seen, okay, that is experienced. Okay. Now, like we said, everything in the prakriti is based on these three gunas. All right, sattva, rajas, and tamas. And people have used different words for those three gunas. So the words that Patanjali has used here are prakasha. Prakasha means light. So he has used the word light for sattva. Okay. Kriya, which means action, for rajas. Okay. Sthiti is stability, dullness. You know, like I said, sitting on a couch and doing nothing, that's sthiti. You don't want to move, don't want to do anything. That's the tamas part. So the three gunas here are, instead of saying sattva, rajas and tamas, he has more kind of descriptive words here. Prakasha means light. Kriya means action. Sthiti means just immobility, so to say. Immobility. That's sthiti. When something is fixed, doesn't move, that sthiti. Situated in some sense. Okay. So drishyam is prakriti, which is the nature of these three gunas, sattva, rajas and tamas, prakash, kriya and sthiti. And also, it, bhuta, what are the bhutas?
Five
elements. And the indriyas? How many?
Five.
Well, when we talk of the indriyas, they talk of 11 senses. Always. Indriyas are 11, which is 5 Mahabhutas, then 5 senses, right? Sense of smell, touch, taste, and everything. Yeah. They are interlinked, right? Yeah. Earth, the element earth, is associated with the sense of
smell.
The element water is the sense of
taste.
Fire is the element of
sight.
Air is the element of
voice.
Huh?
Noise. No, sorry.
Air.
Air breathing.
Yeah, what's the element? What's the sense associated with that?
Skin.
Touch, yes.
Touch.
Air is for touch. And finally, ether is the element of, is the sense of?
Shabda.
Shabda, sound. Very good.
What was the second one?
So earth is associated with smell, water with taste, fire with sight, air with touch, and ether or space with sound, shabda. So these are the 10 senses, so to say. And then the 11th element that's added always in the indriyas is the mind. Because without mind, none of these work. You need the mind to have any sense out of these senses. So they always talk about the bhutas are 5, indriyas are 11. Okay, they are all associated with each other. Okay? So sense of sight, touch and all that, and then 5 sense organs. They are associated organs like ears, nose and everything. And the mind. Okay, so they are always talked about the 11 indriyas, as they say. Indriya is the senses. Okay, so when we talk bhuta indriya, they're talking about 16 of these, basically. 11 plus 5. Okay? Now, the word bhoga here means, we talked about the word bhoga earlier also, Remember the word? There was a bhoga word in the previous one somewhere.
Experience.
Experience. Where was that? There was a word bhoga somewhere here, right? Ah, there it is. Jatyayur bhoga ha. Okay, bhoga means experiences. Okay, it's the same word here. Bhoga. So bhoga is life's experiences. Okay. And apavarga means there's bhoga and apavarga. What's apavarga?
Liberation.
Liberation. Very good. Apavarga is liberation. So the purpose, he says, of drishyam or prakriti is twofold. One is to provide life's experiences, and the other is to help attain liberation.
So you're saying that's prakriti's purpose?
That's right. That's prakriti's purpose, is to provide life's experiences as well as eventually attain liberation or free purusha from its bondage, basically. That's also another way of saying that.
That's prakasha.
No. What is prakasha?
Provide life experiences.
No, that drishyam. Last word is drishyam. Drishyam is prakriti.
Okay, drishyam, the scene.
The scene is the term they use for prakriti. And it provides life experiences and it provides liberation. And the means of doing all that is through these gunas, prakasha, kriya and sthiti, as well as the 11 elements, 11 of these indriyas, so to say. You're just saying that. Okay, so that's what the whole prakriti is, it's all about. And its purpose is to provide life's experiences as well as provide freedom for the purusha from its bondage. It's right now tied, it's right now attached to the ego, identified with the ego, so to say. And we are trying to get rid of that identification so the purusha can become free of its identification. And it's the job of prakriti to do that eventually. All right. Now, this concept of the gunas it plays a big role. Like I said, even in this one also, and then finally in the final sutra, it says, you know, you have to have this final balance of the gunas, which is the only way you can get into nirbija samadhi or the final state of samadhi. So it's a good idea to kind of develop a better understanding of the gunas. So maybe you want to spend some time reading about the gunas and analyzing, understanding in your mind, synthesize the whole concept. It's a pretty involved, in my own mind, you know. I cannot say that I still understand the concept of the gunas very, very thoroughly. I still get doubts when I read stuff. Okay. But it's a good concept to, because that's what it's all about. Prakriti is all about the gunas. So like I keep saying, you know, we don't, at least I haven't read any clear explanation of that, what does the word balance means. Nobody has explained that. So that still remains as a doubt in my mind, what exactly does it mean. Alright. People have actually made, you know, this into a study. We met a person, he is in India, he came here for a visit. And he has a business. And his business is called Triguna. Three gunas. Okay. So what he does is, he has a consulting firm, and he does consultation for students, for corporations, for people who work, for people in crisis in life, and everything, all kinds of people. What does he do? He has a questionnaire. You can pay a little money and then do the questionnaire online also, anyway. So he'll give you a questionnaire. It's about 50 to 60 questions. And you provide honest answer to those questions. And based on that, he determines which of your gunas is more dominant in general, whether it is sattva, rajas, and tamas. And based on that, he will guide you in your life, that you should be doing this as your business or as your profession or as a husband or as a wife. You know, this is how you should modify your life. And he has done a lot of study, on this, and he has made that as a profession. Just study the gunas and guide you in life.
Is it a successful business?
Apparently.
Actually, I have taken that questionnaire, but the thing is, answering those questions are very difficult because you think you are good, but you cannot give an honest answer.
Because the ego is involved. I agree with you. that's not easy. But, when he came here and I met him, he came to a group here. He says it takes several sessions, the initial questionnaire is just the initial questionnaire, it just gives you a starting point. But then he'll have to sit down one-on-one with you to have several sessions, and he understands more in depth. And at every step, you understand more about finer points of each guna, and then you start analyzing it, and then he gives you a full opinion as to what's the best for you. It's a very interesting. You went to his website?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You told him.
Yeah. It's a very interesting website.
Did you follow the advice?
I just said, I was not sure whether I gave the right answer or not. But, based on that, my guna is tamas. So, I didn't go further.
His name is...
Raj.
I even forget his name now. I met him.
There used to be a test called the MMPI test. They had about 550 questions.
Uh-huh.
And you start answering those questions. They used to give about 3 hours to finish it. And as you go on, the follow-up questions, when it comes, you think, what did you answer there? Wrong, it was the wrong answer.
Mm-hmm.
When you go... You answer first question. same question might come in a different form later on. He said, I answered that question wrong. And this question was meant for identifying people who are not a sort of crime-oriented.
Oh, really?
Nuclear power plants or some other more important, people who are the...
Where was this question administered? Where was this done?
If you want to have the entry into the nuclear power plants.
I see.
Okay, so they want to make sure that there is no criminal entering.
I see.
And after all those questions, they have a template. They put on the template all the dots, and if a certain region comes, that means this person could be problematic.
A psychological evaluation.
Psychological evaluation.
Very nice. They should do that more for a lot of other jobs. Too, a teacher
for
or something.
Yeah, for sure.
That's interesting. Okay. Yeah, I would recommend reading, if you ever get the time and the inclination, read Gita. Okay, Gita has a good description of these gunas.
What translation of it, though? There's so many books written about it. It's good.
Which one?
Yeah.
Actually, they recommend one Gita Plus from Gorakhpur, but I found one by Swami Mukundananda.
It's okay.
It's like a 2,000 pages.
Oh, jeez.
But the explanation is very good.
Well, you know, each commentator has a different perspective to put forth, right? The one by Swami Mukundananda, for example, it's very bhakti-oriented, very devotion-oriented, and he does not even touch some of the other points which are not bhakti-oriented. So his commentary is very biased in one direction. If you read the commentary by Swami Yogananda, you know, for example, that's biased on his own concept of Kriya Yoga or the Kundalini aspect of yoga. Okay, so that's biased in that direction. He talks about Kundalini all through the Bhagavad Gita. Chakras and Kundalini and Kriya Yoga and all that. Very biased in that direction. If you read the commentary by, let's say, Swami Dayananda, which is 100% Vedanta-oriented. Okay, very Vedanta-oriented. There's no element of dharma, bhakti or no element of Kundalini, zero. Very pure Vedantic interpretation. If you read the commentary by Swami Shivananda, for example, it's a mix of bhakti and Vedanta. Bhakti and Vedanta. Kind of a mix of those two. But it's not very detailed. It's not very scholastic, so to say. So how do you pick one?
But what are you doing that research on? Like the three gunas, you are doing some work, no? On which book you are?
No. I'm not doing any research. All I'm doing is I'm compiling all the shlokas which have a discussion, which are related to gunas. So what I'm doing is, I'm picking up the Sanskrit, the Devanagari script, their transliteration into English, and their English translation. So these three, for every shloka, I have compiled, basically. No commentary.
Okay,
just the shlokas themselves with the English translation and transliteration. And the Devanagari script. Like I've here, Devanagari, transliteration, and the English meaning. That's all I'm doing. Same thing exactly that I've done here. Okay, so if you're interested, you know, it's a word file, you know, I can always share with you. It doesn't mean anything because it's just list of shlokas.
For Bhagavad Gita, my husband listens to a different speaker, like he listens to them, and it's Balakrishna Shastri girl, like he talks in Tamil. And it's very anecdotal, very relatable. So he will say, like, you know, you take every verse and he kind of relates it to, like, common man, like how, you know, how, yeah, it's very relatable. So something like that is what I would be interested in. If you talk, like, at that level, then you're like, okay, you're just reading it, but you're not actually absorbing it. So,
it's very difficult to pick a commentary that you like because everyone is very different.
Yeah.
And you have a different background and everyone comes up with their own interpretation, with their own understanding. Same as with Yoga Sutras, you know, it's very different from one commentary to another. Alright, so which one have you read?
I don't remember.
Okay.
7 years ago, I don't remember.
Yeah. Well, there's one by Swami Sachidananda, yeah, there's one by Swami Shivananda, they are more readable. There's one by I forget the name now, anyway. That's also fairly readable. Readable means they don't go into the very, very high level depth, you know, very scholastic depth. Okay.
There is one by Tilak.
Tilak, yeah.
Mm-hmm. He's driving towards Karma Yoga.
He's very much based on Karma Yoga. There's one by Eknath Ishwaran.
That's the one I've read.
That's the one you've read. Again, that's more readable. He doesn't go into the very scholastic depth of each shloka, but it's more practical in the sense that you talk.
What was the name?
Eknath Ishwaran. That's more practical, and it's more understandable compared to some of the others. Radha Krishna's, I used to have it, but somebody borrowed it, and I never got it back. So now I don't. That was a good one. Actually, what was best about his book was the introduction, not the actual commentary. His introduction was about 100 pages, which really summarized the essence of Gita in a beautiful manner. I used to find that most fascinating, his introduction.
So it's not in print anymore?
It's not in print anymore, and for some reason, you know, it's not available. That was one of the better ones, actually, by Radhakrishnan. And like I said, you know, I used to be fascinated by the introduction itself. That's it.
Yeah, nowadays, you are not a scholar if you don't write commentary on Bhagavad Gita.
Yeah, that's right, yes.
Everybody has one.
Yeah. Closing. Let's recite Om once now. Take a deep inhalation. Let's join the palms together. We'll do the invocation to Patanjali one more time. Just listen in. Yogen chittasya padena vacham malam sharirasya cha vaidyakena yopakarottam pravaram muninam patanjalim pranjaliranatosmi. Patanjalim pranjaliranatosmi. And the closing Shanti Mantra, Asatoma. Inhale. Om Asatoma Sadgamaya Tamasoma Jyotirgamaya Mrityorma Amritam Gamaya. Om Shanti Shanti. Please lead me from unreal to the real, from darkness to light, and from the fear of death to the knowledge of immortality. Peace, peace, peace. Thank you. Thank you. Namaste, and have a wonderful evening.